Okay, great. Well, good morning. It's nice to be the first one up. Everyone's still caffeinated and a tent full of attention, so it'll be more difficult to put you to sleep here. But so I'm going to summarize some research across the semi-arid environmental gradient that we've been studying in the Sonoran Desert of Arizona, and presenting some data on a couple of different approaches for constraining both weathering rates as well as organic carbon cycling and sequestration. Okay, so we're calling this the Sonoran Desert Environmental Gradient. It's kind of a broad, grandiose term, but essentially looking at the change in process in soils and weathering and carbon cycling across one of these steep elevation gradients where we compress tremendous climatic variation over very short distances. This work originally started, it was funded through a seed grant through this Critical Zone Exploration Network, which essentially is it's a network of sites trying to answer similar questions with the idea of being able to bring data together from these sites. And we're also, as part of a project that was recently funded as part of this NSF Critical Zone Observatory Program. Again, very similar to this network of trying to, and podologists have a good place to represent themselves in these networks. A lot of the work is focusing on processes that occur within the soil system. One of the things when we started this gradient, we're really focusing on quantifying the factors that control both these organic and inorganic carbon cycles in these soil systems. And in particular, I'm going to show some data on climate and soil water and temperature dynamics across this gradient, as well as then constraining organic carbon dynamics with both radiocarbon techniques and some traditional kind of mass balance techniques, and then touch on recent work where we're coupling quantifying mass flux and weathering rates from the soil profile using a couple elemental mass balance and denudation rate component, where we're constraining the denudation rates then with cosmogenic nuclides. So I just want to give some physiographic context. Here, of course, is the contiguous U.S., and this is the PRISM data set. And what this data represents is the percent of the mean annual precipitation that comes during the winter. And so you can see, of course, the western U.S. dominated by winter rainfall and then grading towards summer dominance, and so grading from xeric to ustic to eutic soil moisture regimes. And Arizona then sits right at the crossover point between being winter and summer dominated. So we have a distinct bimodal precipitation regime, and there's some interesting questions then about cold winter rainfall versus hot summer rainfall from convective thunderstorms and the impacts of that then on soil processes. And so focusing on Arizona, looking at the dominant physiographic provinces, we have basically three provinces with the basin and range dominating the southern component, and the Colorado Plateau dominating the northern half of the state. Now, the basin range is characterized by active, or was characterized by active uplift and faulting on the order of 12 to 15 million years ago due to some localized subduction and plate tectonics. And it resulted in this very characteristic landscape of uplifted ranges and then basins infilled with sediment. And so this typically then includes where you have your mountain block and then these deep basins filled with large amounts of sediment that have been accumulating essentially over the last 10 million years, or currently very tectonically quiet, and so this kind of slow denudation of the landscape. And just an idea of the typical soil landscape is you have shallow soils, typically on the bedrock, things like toriorthents or ustorthents on the mountain block itself, and then grading across a series of alluvial fans and fan terraces where you argids, paleoargids, and down to torifluvents then on the young systems. And just kind of an idea of what these landscapes look like, this is actually the Rincon gradient. I'll be presenting some data. One of the old early Pleistocene fans where you have kind of the typical desert scrub system, and you can see some desert pavement developed on the feature, on the surface. And then down on the basin floor where you have these creosote flats. So kind of the typical landscape. And again, folks, what I'll be showing today is focusing on this upland system on the residual bedrock. Okay, so here's that same map. Here's the study area I'll be presenting data for. These are the Santa Catalina Mountains and the Rincon Mountains, and the city of Tucson sits right in this basin here. Phoenix is someplace up there in the low desert. And the area is actually within the Saguaro National Park on the eastern component of that. And we're looking at an elevation gradient, basically a single watershed that drains from high elevation to low elevation. And these elevations grade from about 800 meters to almost 3,000 meters at the high elevation. And it's represented then by this kind of the classic metamorphic core complex, where you had Precambrian granite that intruded into the old metasedimentary rocks. You have some contact metamorphism, so you have often the front ranges are this granitic gneiss, and then you commonly even have caps or chunks of old sedimentary rock that have slid off the top, and then exposing both Precambrian and then Tertiary age granite, which reintruded into the same area at a later time. And actually, this schematic is based on the Tsuwhao National Park, and this kind of scheme and this watershed right here essentially encompasses this component of that landscape. So we're all on granitic parent materials across this gradient. Okay, so in terms of the climate data, this spans a number of ecosystems. We'll be focusing on several of those. At the low elevation, we have desert scrub, and at the other extreme, we have a mixed conifer forest. And the blue bars are the rainfall, so you can see that distinct bimodal precipitation regime, where you get a big slug of rain during the summer monsoon from convective thunderstorms, and as well as then winter rain from cyclonal systems coming off the Pacific. And you can see that orographic effect of rainout is much more pronounced at high elevation during the winter months. Now, some interesting data, temperature data from across this gradient, and this is from a colleague at the University of Arizona, representing about 4 or 5 years worth of data, and looking at the lapse rate with elevation. So the relative decrease in temperature as you move up in elevation, kind of your standard lapse rate constraints here between roughly 3 and 6 degrees C. And what we see across the Rincons is actually we're averaging 9, even up to 10 degrees C per 1,000 meters of elevation of decrease in temperature. So a tremendous gradient in temperature over a relatively short distance. Okay, and so this translates then, finally some soil slides, into a diverse range of soils that vary consistently across this elevation following that gradient in temperature and precipitation. Well, here's that upper Sonoran desert scrub system, kind of a woodland grassland type system with mesquite in the overstory, and then an oak and pinyon and other mixed conifer system at the next elevation. Then up at high elevation, you have mixed conifer, mainly ponderosa pine and some fir. And you can see the gradient from these relatively shallow soils grading up to what we're calling deep soils. These are still only 50 centimeters to a bedrock contact, but it's all relative. And so this is demonstrated then with elevation and precipitation. This depth to bedrock are your lithic or paralithic contact with a steady linear increase with elevation that's likely then controlled by precipitation amount. And if we look at the soil temperature dynamics, so as part of that initial seed grant, we went out and installed soil moisture and temperature probes across this gradient at a number of depths. These data are from surface horizons, roughly 10 centimeter depth across the gradient, where the blue lines are the high elevation ponderosa pine system, and at the other extreme, this red line is the low elevation desert scrub. And so you can see the dramatic difference in surface temperature and the winter cooling. And this then corresponds as well then with the moisture data at the same depth. You see these distinct hot, wet periods during the summer monsoon, and then cool, wet periods corresponding with these low soil temperatures during the winter. It's one interesting to point out here, we're coming out of this distinct hot, dry period pre-monsoon, very warm soil temperatures, and you can see almost a 10 to 15 degree temperature drop in the soil with the onset of those monsoons. So really very dramatic response in these soil systems with that summer rainfall. And it begs some questions then about processes within the system during these hot, wet months, punctuated by these very dry periods in between, and then these cool, wet periods of potentially weathering and then flushing of material during these wet, cold periods. And the other thing to point out is demonstrated nicely here, coming out of the winter rainfall, you see this long tail on the soil moisture in the cool, wet conifer systems where you dry out almost immediately in the desert system. So you have this longer duration of soil moisture related to temperature and the evapotranspiration rates. And these are just data summarizing several years of information looking at the distribution of soil moisture. You can see that for the most part, those cool, wet, high elevation systems remain moist much longer and much more frequent than those hot, dry systems, and you can see that in the median soil moisture content, and then also you can see the dramatic change in soil temperature. Again, these are surface soil temperatures, almost a 15 degree Celsius difference from low to high elevation. Okay, and we're looking at organic carbon stocks. So these are organic carbon, again, basically precipitation temperature as a proxy for elevation. We see increasing carbon stocks with elevation, which you'd expect with the increasing primary production and increasing soil development as you move upwards. And there's also a set of data, a classic study from Whitaker and Nearing, where they quantified above and below ground primary production in the Catalina Mountains, which we can then use as a means to constrain the mean residence time, assuming a steady state production and storage within the soil system. And using these data and the carbon content we measured, we see a mean residence time on the order of 3 to 30 years, so relatively rapid turnover of this organic carbon. But when we couple that with measuring the radiocarbon content of the bulk soil carbon, we see going from positive to less positive values, where it basically translates into older soil carbon as we move up in elevation. And when we model the residence time of this bulk carbon, we actually see these ponderosa pine systems, the residence time based on the radiocarbon is on the order of 300 to 400 years, whereas with the steady state input and carbon balance, we're estimating 30 years. So there's a fraction of old carbon here that isn't being captured in this steady state component. And so to address that, we used basically a time-dependent radiocarbon mass balance, where we used the historic atmospheric CO2 balance, and we're able to model this p-value, which is the fraction in what we're calling a passive pool, and we fixed the mean residence time of that at 500 years, and then looked at the relative distribution of carbon in this fast pool, a mean residence time of less than 15 years, which increases linearly with elevation, and then we see at the high elevation, then we have this kind of threshold shift to a large fraction of passive carbon that turns over relatively long time scales that we're hypothesizing is likely a function of charcoal as these systems tend to burn more frequently, or potentially the litter chemistry difference in those ecosystems. And in terms of the pedogenic strain or mass balance of the mass flux of material out of this profile, we used kind of the classic Brimhall or Chadwick approach to quantifying the mass flux from these profiles, where these tau values quantify the percentage loss or gain of an element, basically normalized to an immobile element. And then you can look at the relative loss normalized to the density of the parent material and then integrate that over the pedon for a total mass flux. And just to demonstrate the kind of end members, here is this relative loss with depth. You can see in the low elevation, again, these relatively shallow profiles, depletion in the upper portion, and actually accumulation in this saprolite layer, which corresponds with their actually identified clay films along the cracks of these saprolites, so it's likely that some of this material is being translocated and precipitated at depth, but not fully removed because of the dry nature of the system. Whereas at high elevation, we see a deepening of that weathering profile and complete our depletion throughout the profile without accumulation necessarily in the subsurface. And integrating that data then across the gradient here, this is the silica flux in moles per square meter plotted versus elevation. We see that nice linear decrease with increasing, basically corresponding to the increasing precipitation we see with elevation. So an increasing mass flux out of these profiles. And if we assume that the cation flux, this is a big assumption, that all of the cation flux calculated from that mass balance was charge balanced by bicarbonate, it gives kind of a high-end estimate of the potential CO2 consumed from weathering reactions. And those are these data here, where again, showing the similar pattern to that silica flux, we're seeing increasing CO2 consumption from that weathering reaction. Again, this is a high-end, not a very conservative estimate of the potential CO2 consumption. But when we compare this to the organic carbon stored within these soils, we can note that across the entire gradient, this inorganic CO2 consumption is on the order of 2 to 3 times greater than what is stored as organic carbon. So it suggests that over the lifetime of these soils, that actually the weathering processes is much more important to the carbon cycle dynamics than the rapid turnover of these carbon pools. Remember, these have residence time of 3 to 300 years. And finally, we then coupled that mass balance data then with to get at weathering rates and erosion rates. 2 minutes, okay. Using essentially cosmogenic nuclide production within the profile. And this is assuming a steady state depth, so that D, or this denudation, if this depth doesn't change over time, then it's balanced by the mass loss and the chemical weathering rate. So essentially the conversion of parent material to soil is then equivalent to the material loss from physical erosion and chemical weathering. And we were using beryllium-10 concentrations in quartz grains at this saprolite bedrock contact. And then you can estimate the weathering using this mass balance approach, very similar to the tau values we use for the mass flux. Okay, well, on average, the total denudation, so this is both chemical and physical erosion, about 34 meters per million years. And this equates to soil residence time. If you take that physical erosion component and divide the soil depth by that, you get soil residence times on the order of 6 to 30,000 years. So actually, this number surprised me. It's older than we had assumed. And just to go through these data, these are essentially then broken up. Here's the weathering rate with elevation. And again, in terms of mass flux per meter squared per year, you can see this kind of linear increase, much like we saw with the mass flux from the silica and other components. In terms of the physical erosion, we see this kind of threshold where we have very high physical erosion that then drops when we move to a grassland-dominated system and then steadily creeps back up as you start to lose the grass understory in the pine. So there's a relation then between the vegetation and the physical erosion rate. And then this is the percentage of that total denudation that's attributed to weathering. So again, kind of this nonlinear increase that captures this dynamic here of the percentage of that total denudation that can be attributed to chemical weathering. 1 minute. Okay, so just to summarize, climate first order control, as you might expect, mainly through water timing and availability. Temperature is not limiting other than limiting soil moisture duration. Carbon cycle magnitude and scaling, very rapid cycling of organic carbon in these systems. So carbon that's replaced on the order of every 3 to 350 years in soils with residence times of 6 to 30,000 years. So very replacement of this organic carbon numerous times over the lifetime of the soil, whereas weathering processes is a slow, steady consumption of CO2 over time. And then this variation in denudation with climate, both these patterns in physical and chemical weathering. And where we're going is to start to try and couple these short and long-term processes in model space. And so I'll just end on that slide because I think that's my last minute. Oh, I did put everybody to sleep.
On your carbon turnover, about what percent at the high end versus the low end, what was the percent of the passive or the slow of the total? What was the percent? How did that compare to the low end?
At the high end, it was almost 50% of the carbon is that slow, and at the low end, it was less than 2%. So really, it's not in all those three low-end ecosystems, the carbon is turning over within decadal timescales.
And those are grasses or shrubs? What are
It's desert scrub, grasses, and shrubs. Mm-hmm. And so the carbon is really not sticking around very long.